From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Happy birthday to Coast listener Sally. Hope you had a great one, Sal. Later tonight, Hollywood and Jesus. Here's what's happening. With upwards of 300 record high temperatures in jeopardy this week, more than an eighth of the United States population, over 40 million people, are on alert across the western U.S. for a long-lasting, potentially lethal heat wave. Just what we need. This heat wave and the exceptional drought in the Southwest are part of a damaging feedback loop enhanced by climate change, according to the experts. The hotter it gets, the drier it gets, and the drier it gets, the hotter it gets. You can't win. Sad news to report tonight. Coast to Coast guest Robert Felix, author of Not by Fire, But by Ice, has passed away. And he was a dear friend of the show. He was born in Plainfield, Vermont in 1942, served his country for 4 years in the United States Air Force, studied architecture at the University of Minnesota, after which he became a designer for the next 25 years, moved to Seattle, then started researching climate change. Wrote two books on the subject, the one I just mentioned, and also Magnetic Reversals and Evolutionary Leaps. Robert Felix, dear friend of the show, has passed on. The Federal Reserve has brought forward its predictions for the first post-pandemic interest rate hikes into 2023 and opened the debate on when and how it may appropriate to start tapering the U.S. Central Bank's massive bond buying program. Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Shadlock. Mish, does that mean rates are going to skyrocket again?
I don't think so, George. By the time they get around to hiking, you know, they're going to be almost ready to cut. I mean, this is the pattern with the Fed. Yep. If you actually look at the statement that they made today, they hardly changed a word from last month. Here, I'll just read you a phrase. The committee will aim to achieve inflation moderately above 2% for some time so that inflation averages 2% over time. Okay? They're looking for over 2% for some time, allegedly, to make up for lost inflation. Now, the CPI is up 5% year over year. The real wages are declining. People are getting 2, maybe 3% wages with inflation up 5%. They're actually falling further and further behind. I was reading a tweet chain tonight by someone who I respect a lot, and he was talking about what's going on in China, and he said, oh, look at this. China is suppressing deposit rates, and it's punishing savers. I was sitting there thinking, how is this any different than what the U.S. is doing, Japan is doing, the ECB is doing? It's inflation is a tax on consumers and savers, George. It especially hurts the poor. And so is financial repression by the Fed when you purposely sponsor inflation like this. By the time they get around to hiking, they're going to be just a year or so away from cutting rates again.
All right, my friend. I always love your commentary, Mish. Thank you. A Spanish man was sentenced to just 15 years in prison after killing and eating his 68-year-old mother 2 years ago. Police arrested Alberto Gomez after they found body parts, some in plastic containers in the refrigerator, and in drawers around the family's home. Maria Gomez's head, hands, and heart were found on her bed, while the rest of her body was cut into about 1,000 pieces. Police went to the house after a friend reportedly called police concerned about Maria. Hadn't seen her in a couple years. What a story. Jeez. Over the next few weeks, a company called Kernel, and that's with a K, will begin sending dozens of customers across the U.S. a $50,000 helmet that can apparently read their minds. Weighing a couple of pounds each, the helmets contain nests of sensors and other electronics that measure and analyze a brain's electrical impulses and blood flow at the speed of thought, providing a window into how the organ responds to the world. Incredible technology. Howard Bloom, author of The Global Brain, is with us. Howard, they're going to read our minds?
Yes. Imagine a helmet that will allow you to transfer your ideas directly from your mind to the mind of a friend. Imagine conveying emotions to your mate more richly than language has ever allowed you to do. Imagine searching the web for what you need with only your thoughts and doing it at near instant speed. Imagine having the songs that grow through your head and the songs that you hear in the street identified whenever you want, or getting instant identification for the songbirds you hear in the park, the stars you see from your backyard, and the faces and biographies of people you walk past in the street. So this new Colonel $50,000 helmet will do almost all of this. And this helmet will do the work of five roomfuls of current brain-sensing machines, including functional magnetic resonance imagers, functional near-infrared spectroscopes, electroencephalographs, magnetoencephalographs, and positron emission tomographs. Bloomberg reports that this helmet is designed to help researchers understand Alzheimer's, brain aging, mental disorders, concussions, strokes, Parkinson's disease, Jeez. And the mechanics behind previously metaphysical experiences, such as meditation and psychedelic trips. The new helmet is also designed to help find the most effective exercises to revive a brain that's been damaged, or the most effective way to do your meditation. The creator of the helmet, 44-year-old former Venmo owner Brian Johnson, thinks of it as a machine that will truly help you know yourself, and the machine that will let you use the artificial intelligence to gain superpowers. The company that's developed this miracle device is exactly what you said, Brian Johnson's baby, Colonel. It's located in the two-story lab in a residential area of Venice, California, and Colonel's goal is the ultimate machine for the study of the brain, and the ultimate machine with which you can understand your own brain and use your brain in whole new ways. And there's another goal. The current customers are research labs, as you said, like Harvard's Medical School, the University of Texas, and California's Institute for Advanced Consciousness Studies. But by 2030, after research institutions, universities, early adopters, and the wealthy have purchased their helmets, Colonel is hoping to work down the price so its helmets can be as common as cell phones. Now, actually, there are two Colonel helmets. One uses laser pulses to measure changes in blood oxygenation. Its secret is a miniaturized photon diffusion detector. And the other measures the brain's electrical activity using miniaturized optically pumped magnetometers. Hopefully someday the two functions will be merged in a single helmet for brain researchers, psychologists, and specialists in mass behavior like me. The helmets will be the research tool of our dreams, allowing us to do studies with thousands of volunteers at the push of a button. Bloomberg reports that Christoph Koch, chief scientist of the Allen Institute for Brain Science in Seattle, calls Colonel's devices revolutionary. MIT neuroscientist Edward Boyden says about Colonel's founder, Johnson, everybody he's recruited to Colonel is amazing. David Boas, director of the Neurophotonics Center at Boston University, says this unlocks a whole new universe of research. And Bloomberg reports that the helmet can even be used to study the root causes of American political polarization.
Are you going to wear it?
I would love to have one. You should have one, too. We can communicate by thought.
No, thanks. Thanks, Howard. Capitol Hill lawmakers say that UFOs could pose a pressing threat to America's national security, as it has emerged from a highly classified briefing with Navy and FBI officials on the unexplained phenomenon. Ahead of the release of a highly anticipated Pentagon report on UFOs before Monday's end, members of the House Intelligence Committee received a hush-hush sneak preview, folks. As for the existence of extraterrestrial life, the lawmakers largely left the secrets inside the surveillance-proof room, declining to tell reporters what they've learned so far. But some did voice concerns about UFOs, which may be espionage assets controlled by our foreign adversaries as well. We'll find out soon enough what the heck's going on. The late John Glenn Jr., engineer, former United States Marine Corps aviator, astronaut, businessman, and politician. He was the third American into space and the first American to orbit the Earth, circling it three times in 1962.
Roger, zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous. Roger, turnaround has started. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful. Roger, seven, you have a go, at least seven orbits. Roger, understand go for at least seven orbits.
Amazing. Just amazing. And he went up into space later on in the space shuttle as well at the age of 77. Just a tremendous guy. In a moment, Jeff Sessions joins us. We're going to be talking about Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the new battleground of the Cold War next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Jeff Sessions with us, speechwriter, cartoonist, author, founding partner of West Wing Writers, a Washington, D.C. consulting firm. Now, from 1994 to 98, he wrote the nationally syndicated cartoon Thatch. He then served as a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton between 98 and 2001. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. What's it like being a presidential speechwriter?
Well, you know, it was a pretty exciting job. I have to say, getting to work in that building every day and getting a window into how presidents make decisions, having a role in helping him to articulate those decisions and make the case for what it is that he's trying to do, it was really a thrill and an honor to get to do that.
Was he a good guy to work for?
He was a terrific guy to get to work for. He really was. And I think the speechwriters felt it particularly because here, Bill Clinton, you know, whether you agree with him or disagree with him politically, I think most people agree he's a pretty good speaker. And he cared a lot about speeches and cared a lot about communications. And so he was very invested in it. It was not a matter of simply handing him a speech and he'd go off and do it. It was a matter of really collaborating with him to make sure that it achieved what it was that he wanted it to achieve.
Were you involved with speech writing at all on any of the Lewinsky stuff that he spoke about?
No, I wasn't. You know, that was pretty well contained with his small group of lawyers who were advising him on that set of questions. And the rest of us got to focus on the business of the American people, as we said. We had a lot to do and a lot to write about. And so thankfully, I didn't have to get involved in that.
Would you have written for Hillary Clinton had she gotten elected?
I don't think I probably would have gone into work at the White House again. I'm pretty happy doing what I'm doing, but I did work with her during the campaign. I was involved in working on her convention speech and some other things, and so I was a big supporter and trying to lend a hand as I could, but I don't think I probably would have gone back in at this point in my career.
Now, you've written an incredible book called Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, the New Battleground of the Cold War. Tell me how you got involved in that.
Well, I grew up learning about the space age, sort of obsessed with space, like a lot of kids and a lot of adults. And I understood that there was something special about John Glenn, and I, of course, knew that he was the first American to orbit the Earth. But when he died in 2016, and there was such a huge outpouring in the country, a sense of loss of this national hero, and also of the kind of national hero that we don't seem to create too many of anymore. I wanted to understand more about what he achieved, but also I come at this from a background in political history. That's my background, and I wanted to understand Glenn's achievement in political and geopolitical context. Why was this so important? Why was this particular flight so important? And it really, I think, has to be understood in the context of the Cold War. We all know that the space race was a Cold War contest, and yet I think when we call it a race, we render it, you know, like the Olympics or some kind of good-spirited international competition. This was seen at the time by President Kennedy and by most Americans and really by people across the free world as an existential struggle between two systems, between freedom and totalitarianism. And what happened in space was seen to have an enormous impact in terms of life on Earth.
And we were getting clobbered by the Soviet Union at the time. They sent Sputnik up in 57, scared the living daylights out of most Americans. They got the first man into space. They had the first man orbit the globe. We had to catch up and catch up fast, didn't we?
We did, and we weren't catching up fast. I mean, that span of first that you just described there, George, that's 4 years worth. I mean, Sputnik went up in 1957. The first man, Yuri Gagarin, orbits the Earth in April of 1961. I mean, that's almost 4 years, and it was one thing after another where the Soviets were achieving these spectacular firsts, some of which we've forgotten about by now. They, after sending the first satellite into space, that was Sputnik, They then sent the first animal into space. They sent the dog Laika. They sent the first human-made craft to crash land on the moon. It was the first time anything that we built here on Earth had touched the surface of the moon. They built a spacecraft that went around and took pictures of the far side of the moon, which human beings had never seen before. So it was one thing after the other, and the American space program did not seem to have its footing for years.
Jeff, how scared were we as a nation about the Soviets and what they were doing with the possibility of militarizing space?
Profoundly scared. You know, the United States, as we said that our purposes in space were peaceful, Soviets said the same thing, but nobody ever believed that the Soviets' purposes anywhere were peaceful. And there was a lot of concern here in this country, and concern might be putting it mildly, concern that the Soviets were going to build, for example, a space station that would just sit in orbit above the United States, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons. There was serious talk, and I'm talking about defense experts and Pentagon planners and others, who really believed that the Soviets would eventually build a nuclear base on the moon that would put it outside the reach of U.S. defenses. These were the sorts of things that were talked about in congressional hearings and stories on the front page of major newspapers. And so the drumbeat of fear was profound, and it was felt not only in the United States but across Western Europe, among our allies, and in other parts of the world.
There was some concern that John F. Kennedy wasn't going to make a commitment into space. Then he gets elected, and then he went after the administration for letting things fail in space. And he just, you know, did a tremendous job of pushing NASA. And I think he was the impetus for, you know, the growth of our space race.
He absolutely was, and there was a kind of irony in that he was reluctant to fully engage. He had run in 1960 saying that it was unacceptable and dangerous for the United States to be second in space, that being second in space meant being second in the eyes of the world in science and technology and military power and in that existential struggle that I mentioned between two systems. And so Kennedy said it was unacceptable, but he didn't have a plan to get the U.S. into first place. And when he became president, he inherited a whole mess of problems around the world and began to grapple with those. And space just did not rise to the top of his agenda until Yuri Gagarin orbited the Earth. And then suddenly it was clear that the United States needed to figure out what it was going to do and whether there was any way for the country to catch up with the Soviet Union. And there was not actually a lot of confidence in this country that we could do it.
Why do you think the Soviets, who were really pushing space, seemed to stop when we got to the moon?
Well, they were trying to get to the moon. The Soviets did not give up, and they continued to experiment in the late 1960s with a lunar program. But by that point, the rot had really set into the Soviet program, and many of the problems that they were able to forestall in the early 1960s had really come home to roost because, of course, the technology involved in trying to get human beings to the moon is so much more complex than simply throwing someone up into orbit. And you know, the Soviets had actually achieved quite a lot over the course of the 1960s, but there were the bureaucratic system, the divisions within the Politburo, the lack of accountability, the lack of transparency, the excessive secrecy, all of these things ultimately doomed the Soviet lunar program.
The focus of your book, Mercury Rising, of course, has a lot to do with John Glenn. And wasn't he very, very upset that they picked Alan Shepard as the first American to go into space and not him?
He was profoundly upset. And in fact, the press was upset. And in fact, the American people were upset. They didn't have anything particularly against Alan Shepard, but Glenn was the standout. Glenn was the only one, really, of the Mercury 7 who was a beloved public figure. And there was a general assumption that Glenn would win, that Glenn would win that competition and he would be the first in space. And Glenn himself believed it. So it was a huge shock to his system when Alan Shepard was selected to go first. And by the way, then Gus Grissom was selected to go second. And
that's
Glenn
right.
Was told to be the backup to both of those astronauts. So it was deeply humiliating to him. And Glenn refused to take no for an answer. He actually lodged a protest with Bob Gilruth, who was the head of the Space Task Group, and said, I want you to reconsider. which Gil Ruth refused to do. But it was a very dark period for Glenn, and he was pretty sullen around the house. His family remembered, his friends could see it, and actually one of his closest friends took him aside at one point and said, "You got to shake yourself out of this."
Hold on, Jeff. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Mercury Rising, and we'll get into the John Glenn story a little bit more. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie back with you. Jeff Sessel with us. Jess, these astronauts are competitive. I was talking to a friend of Buzz Aldrin's last week, and Buzz really wanted to be the first man on the moon.
Sure he did. He famously did. And I think it was tough for him not to be. I talk to my kids about it sometimes, and they say, "He's right there. He was only a couple of minutes later." But I think it's a tough thing to take.
Yep, sure was. Now, what made you key in on John Glenn for the book Mercury Rising?
Well, Glenn was really the star attraction of the Mercury 7. There was something about his personality that really shone more brightly than any of the others. And in fact, his flight did as well. And I really wanted to understand what made him tick. You know, I had seen the right stuff, of course, like so many people. I'd read the book. I'd read a lot of the popular accounts. And Glenn is always described the same way, as a Boy Scout, as a Sunday school teacher, as kind of a prim guy. And it seemed to me that there was some truth to all that, and yet there had to be more to John Glenn, or he never would have been able to achieve what he achieved. I mean, this was not just a Sunday school teacher and a scout. This was actually the most decorated combat veteran of all of the Mercury 7. Some of the other astronauts hadn't even fought in combat. Alan Shepard had not fought in combat, and it was sort of a sore spot for him. But Glenn had fought in World War II. He had flown Corsairs in the South Pacific, and he had fought in Korea as well, and shot down a number of MiGs, and was well on his way toward becoming a flying ace when the war ended. That was his great disappointment at the end of the war, was that he didn't have time to rack up more kills. And he was quite frank about what he was there to do. He was not there to have fun. He was there to get a job done, and he was pretty fierce in getting it done.
The original Mercury 7 astronauts, they're all dead now, but most of them did not get along with John Glenn, did they?
They did not. Scott Carpenter did, and they had a close relationship, the two of them. But the other five really kept their distance from Glenn. There were a couple of reasons for this. One was his celebrity. I mean, the fact that Glenn was actually famous before he was an astronaut. Glenn had become famous in 57, so a couple of years before the astronauts were chosen. He had become famous as a test pilot who had set a speed record flying a jet from Los Angeles to Brooklyn in 3 hours and 23 minutes. He wound up on the front page of every newspaper in America. He wound up a contestant on Name That Tune, a very popular game show on CBS, and he was on prime time week after week in his uniform, charming America. So when Glenn reemerges in 59 as an astronaut, he's already a star. And he's also the most at ease in front of the cameras. And the cameras just loved him. He was funny. He was relaxed. He was humble. He would talk about his family. He would talk about his faith. And the others were pretty tight-lipped fighter jocks. They were there to fly. They were not there to charm the newsreel cameras, but Glenn was there to do both, and they resented it, and frankly, they resented it for the rest of their lives. If you read their memoirs, they talk about that very first press conference, and they feel that Glenn was hamming it up, and maybe he was, maybe he wasn't, but they were not capable of doing that, and they resented it.
Well, he was a consummate politician, because when he got elected to the Senate in 1974, he was a shoo-in, but he was very comfortable in speaking engagements.
He was. He was somebody who had been in front of the cameras by 74. He'd been in front of the cameras for almost a couple of decades. And so he was not awed by any of that. He was not in need of attention. This was not the first time he was at center stage. And so he had that sense of confidence. He really had his feet very much on the ground.
Why do you think it was a stroke of luck that Glenn followed Shepard and Grissom?
Well, Shepard and Grissom flew what were called suborbital flights, and Jeff Bezos is about to take one of those next month on
the
new Shepard rocket.
And then Richard Branson, they're going to try to race each other, I guess.
That's right, the new space race. But a suborbital flight is exactly that. It doesn't get into orbit because they were riding a rocket, the Redstone, that was not powerful enough to push a capsule with a human being on it into orbit. And that rocket, the Atlas rocket, just wasn't ready. It had all sorts of problems. It was exploding on the launch pad, and the U.S. program was not ready to send a man into orbit. So Shepard and Grissom had to settle for these 15-minute flights where they went up and they fell down, and that was that. And Glenn was actually in line third for another one of these flights. But by this point, the Russians now had orbited not just one, but two of their cosmonauts. And it had just become too embarrassing for NASA to continue to do these, what they called short shots. And they had to accelerate the orbital program. But there were still very serious worries about that Atlas rocket that I mentioned, that it just wasn't ready and it wasn't going to get ready. And in fact, even on the eve of John Glenn's flight, the president of Convair Astronautics, which was the company that built the Atlas rocket, would only allow that it had a 4 in 5 chance of succeeding.
Oh, my God.
It had a 1 in 5 chance of something horrible happening to John Glenn.
Now, Shepard and Grissom, didn't they go above with a Redstone rocket?
They briefly went into space. They were weightless for a few minutes, and then gravity kicks in, and they came just straight down. They were not able to actually get high enough to get into orbit and to lock into orbit and counter.
But they had Redstone rockets that got them up there, right?
That's right. Those were Redstone rockets. That's right. But Glenn was the first to ride that Atlas.
Remarkable. Just a remarkable story. And he never was in Gemini, which was the dual ships.
He was not in Gemini. He would have liked to be. And he stuck around because he expected that, of course, he would get back in the rotation. That was always the plan. It was never supposed to be one and done. But the resentment that the other astronauts felt toward Glenn was not limited to the astronaut. Some of the NASA managers also resented Glenn. They thought he was too much of a showboat. They felt that he needed to be kind of put in his place, and so they kept him out of the rotation. And they essentially gave him the runaround for a couple of years, not telling him that he wouldn't fly, but never allowing him to fly again. And finally, Glenn, by 64, had gotten the message it wasn't going to happen, and he dropped out of the program and began his career in politics.
How did going into the space shuttle and at the age of 77 happen for him?
Well, Glenn, at that point in the late 90s, was nearing the end of his fourth term as a senator from Ohio, and he was going to retire. He was 77 years old in 1998. And he was doing some research on the effects of aging. This was an issue that he worked on as a senator. And he began to think, well, look, they've got all of this data on me in 1962 when I was 40, 41 years old. I wonder what would happen if I went into space today. They could do a longitudinal study and compare me at age 77 with me at age 40. And, of course, this was not a purely scientific inquiry. Glenn was desperate to get back into space, in part for the reason that I mentioned a minute ago, that he had gotten boxed out of the program back in the 60s. And so he made his case to Dan Golden, who was the administrator of NASA at the time. It took some time. He sold Golden on the idea. They took it to President Clinton, who approved it. Glenn passed every physical test that the younger astronauts passed. That was a prerequisite of this being able to work. And in October of 1998, he went back into space.
That's remarkable. Just remarkable. Now, he was never part of Apollo because he had resigned before that, didn't he?
That's right. I mean, it was the writing was on the wall. He could finally see it, that he was not going to get a chance to go to the moon. And they were kind of nudging him to take a desk job at NASA and move into the administration of NASA. That wasn't what he wanted to do. He wanted to fly, and it was just too painful for him to stick around at a desk job. So he decided that he needed to just move to another realm altogether. He'd always been interested in politics, President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy had encouraged him to run for Senate, and he felt that it was finally time.
We're coming up on 52 years since we were last on the moon, first on the moon, but Russia still hasn't done anything. Still.
Well, China is more likely to get there soon than Russia at this point.
And maybe even us.
They're talking about going back. And Russia, for all of its continued activity in space, does not seem to be quite as focused on the moon as the U.S. or China.
I mean, China's building space stations, going to Mars with the rovers, and they're all over the place, aren't they?
They've got three Chinese astronauts on their way up right now to their space station. It's the first astronauts from China going up, I believe, in 5 years.
Why aren't they working with the Federation?
Well, China has generally taken a go-it-alone approach in space, and I think that, in fact, one of the leaders of their space program made it plain today. And this actually, I think, very much recalls the history that we're talking about. He said that a nation that is showing its prowess in space is clearly a nation with great and advanced technology here on Earth. That space is a projection of power on Earth. It is a very powerful symbol today, just as it was in the early 60s.
Did Kennedy know John Glenn well?
He did know Glenn well. He saw something in Glenn that he didn't see in the other astronauts. He saw that political ability, that political instinct, and that leadership quality. You know, Alan Shepard was a phenomenal pilot and was chosen first, as you mentioned. But Shepard was never interested in being the leader of the group. Shepard was interested in being the winner. He wanted to go first. Now, of course, they all did. But Glenn had always been a leader, and that was the role that Glenn saw for himself. And so he also had a very strong impulse toward public service. And he felt that he was serving his country, of course, as a Marine pilot, and then later as an astronaut, that he was advancing U.S. interests around the world by being an astronaut. And so it was natural, from Glenn's view, that he would try to do that in political office.
When Kennedy made his famous speech, "We Choose to Go to the Moon," he really captured the nation, didn't he?
He did. And, you know, what's interesting about that speech, so that was the speech that he gave at Rice University in September of 1962.
You would have loved to have written that one, huh?
Boy, yeah, that's one for the ages. That's truly one of the great speeches ever made by a president. And what's interesting about that is how different it is from the previous speech that he made in part about the moon. When he announced the goal that the United States would send men to the moon by the end of the decade, that was back in May of 1961, just after Alan Shepard had gone up. And that's a very bold statement. But if you watch the rest of that speech, and I encourage people to pull it up on YouTube, you can watch the whole speech, he goes off script after he says that. And he begins to get a little awkward and uncomfortable, which is not how you usually see John Kennedy. And he starts to shuffle the pages on the podium, and
like he's lost, crumble. Like he's lost in a speech or something.
He is, and what he goes on to say extemporaneously is, "This is going to be really hard, and this is going to be really expensive, and you, the Congress, and you, the American people, need to think really hard about whether we're going to do this. Because the worst thing would be if we were to commit to this, and then at some point along the path to the moon, we give up and we decide it's not worth the effort. That would be worse than not going at all." And he got in the presidential limo to head back to the White House afterwards, and he turned to his speechwriter, Ted Sorensen, and he said essentially, I don't think they were buying it. He was reading the audience, the body language of the members of Congress, and he felt like they're not buying this.
No commitment.
That's right. And they gave him the money that he asked for because it was seen as a national security investment. But they were not sold on the notion that the United States either needed to go to the moon or that it could go to the moon.
Those were amazing times. I remember them. And they were just rallied the country together.
Well, it did become a unifying goal. And I think that by the time of that speech that you mentioned, that speech at Rice, Kennedy has really decided that he is all in. I mean, he had announced the goal, but now that second speech was after John Glenn had gone up and orbited the Earth, after Scott Carpenter had done the same thing. There was some momentum in the program, and Kennedy really was trying to make sure that that momentum got locked in. There was always the danger that Congress was going to lose interest in the program, that it was going to cut funding, and it was often threatening to do that. And so Kennedy was trying to keep the energy up and keep the sense of optimism up that we really could do this and that we really had to do this.
Where do we get your book, Mercury Rising?
Well, you should be able to get it pretty much anywhere, any bookstore, the chains, the independents. You can get it on Amazon, and you can also go to my website, which is Mercury Rising Book, BK, mercuryrisingbk.com.
Super. We've got your other website, too, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Can they find it that way?
They can, yes. It'll link to that as well.
Jeff, we're going to come back in a moment and take a final hour of phone calls with you from our incredible listeners right here on Coast to Coast as we talk about Mercury Rising, John Glenn, John Kennedy, and the new battleground in the Cold War. That's next on Coast to Coast AM.